Hi there, welcome to Explain This, a podcast where we try to explain complex things in simpler ways for people of all ages. I'm your host, Jin Kim, and today we'll talk about vital signs, important physical signs used in healthcare to assess whether a person might have a life-threatening medical condition or not. Special shout out to Heidi for inspiring this topic today. Today's episode will primarily be at a level suitable for the layperson, but I'll try to sneak some extra something-somethings for the medical folk who are keen listeners to the podcast. Let's get started. Let's say that you went for a walk and you came across a person lying on the ground. They don't wake up despite you yelling at them or slapping their face, which really shouldn't be your first response to seeing an unconscious person in the first place. How can you tell if they're dead or not? Even a non-medical person will know that if they come across a person who isn't breathing and is room temperature to the touch, they should probably wipe their fingerprints from nearby surfaces and call the police, because that person is hella dead. A particularly clever person might even take a pulse, either in the neck or the wrist. Just like that, you've checked all four vital signs to see if the person is alive or dead. Vital signs are four physiological signs that doctors, nurses, and paramedics use not only to assess if a person is dead or not, but a person's general health. It's a relatively quick, easy, and non-invasive way to get a snapshot of someone's clinical state, while acting as a universal, objective, measurable record of a person's health during their stay in hospital. So, in today's episode, we're going to talk about what the four vital signs are, why they're useful, how we measure them, and even talk about the super secret fifth vital sign. Hopefully by the end of it, you'll have a better understanding of why the nurse is squeezing your arm with an inflatable band, or staring at your chest intently for a minute when you're at the hospital. As usual, let's start off by explaining the vital signs to you as if you're a child. When people are sick and have to go to hospital, there's all kinds of things doctors and nurses can look at to figure out what's making you sick. They can feel your tummy, shine a light in your eye, take a see-through photo of your bones, and even read the electricity of the heart. But some of the simplest things that can be looked at to see if you're healthy or sick are something called the vital signs. These are things we can measure to see how alive you are. The first is your temperature. The cells in your body, the teeny tiny building blocks that made up you, need to be at a comfy 36 degrees Celsius to do their best work. They're a bit picky like that. So your body does its best to keep the body temperature at a really specific number, because otherwise the body packs is sad. Too cold and your body kind of goes to sleep, but too hot and you can literally start cooking like a roast chicken. The second vital sign is your pulse, which is how fast your heart is beating. You know, how when you go running around the park, it feels like your heart's going boom, 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 boom really fast in your chest. That's because it's trying to pump more blood to all your muscles. But if your heart is beating very fast, even though you hadn't been running, then doctors might know that your body is sick in another way, like when you have a really nasty virus. The third is your blood pressure. Your heart is a muscle that squeezes blood through tubes called blood vessels to deliver fuel to the rest of your body. To push blood all the way from your chest to your toes, to your head, and back to your chest, it needs to keep pumping and pushing the blood to create enough pressure. It's like how if you want to water the garden with a hose, you need to keep the tap running to fuel the hose with water, which pushes water out the other end. If there's a leak in the hose, then the pressure drops and you can't push water through, so it just dribbles out the tip. If you open the tap too much, however, and there's too much water in the hose, the high pressure might damage the hose and make it burst. It's the same for your blood vessels. Too little pressure means you can't get the blood where it needs to be, like your organs. But if you have way too much pressure, the blood vessels can burst and you can bleed inside your brain. So it's pretty important for doctors and nurses to check the pressure. Lastly, we look at how fast you are breathing. Thankfully, your brain breathes for you automatically, unless I was to remind you of that and you can't stop thinking about how to breathe normally. Anyway, when you're sick, your body needs more oxygen, so your brain makes you breathe faster to get more fresh air into the body. If there's something wrong with your lungs because of, say, a bug or because you smoke cigarettes because you're a bad kid, then your body needs to breathe even faster to make up for that. Now, normally we only talk about these four as D vital signs, but there's secretly a fifth one that doctors and nurses always check in hospital. That's the oxygen level in your blood. Using science and how light works, we can see how well your blood is carrying oxygen throughout your body, which is important because without oxygen, you die. Your blood has special proteins that can carry oxygen called hemoglobin. What we can do with these pulse ox machines is see how many hemoglobins are carrying oxygen in your blood versus slacking off and not carrying oxygen. If your body's behaving, almost 100% of your hemoglobin will be happily carrying oxygen. But if you're sick, like having really bad COVID, then that number will be lower. So it's a very nifty tool we use in the hospital to quickly check how well the body is moving oxygen around. And that's basically the vital signs in less than 5 minutes. Welcome back. So as you probably can guess from the name vital, the vital signs are literally signs that show that you are alive. Sort of. The easiest way to think of the vital signs are that there are some of the quickest, easiest ways we have in medicine to gauge how sick someone might be. We've talked about homeostasis on this podcast many times, the concept that the body likes to keep a tightly controlled environment so that everything works smoothly and without death. The vital signs fall into this category as well. If everything is running normally, the vital signs will be stable and within an expected normal range. But if something's going wrong, the body has many mechanisms to try and maintain homeostasis, which is reflected in changes to the vital signs, almost like a check engine light on a car dashboard. The vital signs let us monitor some core functions of certain vital organs, such as the heart, lungs, and brain. So naturally, knowing how to measure them and interpreting them is a core part of medicine too. So important, in fact, that many of them have been used for thousands of years. We know that even ancient Babylonians understood the importance of the pulse, as seen by the epic hero king Gilgamesh lamenting that his friend has no heartbeat, thus he is dead. The art of pulse-taking, or Ars Phygmica, is still a core part of traditional Chinese medicine, and there are countless examples of how physicians from ancient Egypt to Greece to India all found it was a useful clinical sign to diagnose and treat people. As we mentioned, the four universal vital signs in modern medicine are body temperature, heart rate, blood pressure, and the respiratory rate. Today, we'll cover what each of these signs are, how we measure them, and what abnormal vital signs might suggest. We're also going to talk about one more important clinical sign called the oxygen saturation, and discuss why it's often called the fifth vital sign. So, without further ado, let's talk about the first one. The first vital sign we'll talk about is possibly the one everyone is most familiar with measuring themselves. Body temperature. When people are unwell and they think they might have a cold, one of the first things they do is put their hand on their forehead to check if they feel hot. And no, I don't mean in the, I'm so hot kind of way. The human body runs at a surprisingly steady temperature range, from about 35.5 to 37.5 degrees Celsius. That's a 2 degree margin, almost as accurate as a sous vide machine. And the reason is simple, it's the perfect operating temperature for your cells, and more specifically, enzymes, special protein tools that do all the important work around your body. If it's too cold, the chemical reactions in your body slow down, because you need heat energy to get the chemicals all excited and zipping around. But if it's too hot, then the proteins literally cook, like when you see egg white go from clear to solid when it's fried. Cooked proteins are pretty useless in the body, so you'll eventually die. Therefore, the body is really anal about keeping the body temperature tight. It regulates this through various means, such as sweating and drawing blood close to the skin so that the heat can radiate out when you're hot, or shivering to generate heat when you're cold. You can check a person's temperature very crudely with your hands. If you put one hand on their forehead and another on yours, you can tell if they're the same temperature as you, or if they're hotter or colder. Assuming that you're both not sick, you should be roughly the same temperature. But of course, this isn't a very objective test. I mean, what if you're the sick one? So instead, we used thermometers. In the old days, these would have red dyed alcohol or mercury inside, which would expand when exposed to heat, letting you know what temperature someone was sitting at, if you stuck the thermometer in their mouth, armpit, or butthole. Oh yeah, turns out, the most accurate place you can measure someone's body temperature is in their rectum, because it's literally inside them, whereas the mouth and armpit and ears can be cooler or hotter depending on environmental factors. Luckily, we saved this route mostly for babies, because they can't complain. Slash, the other methods are a lot less accurate for newborn babies. Nowadays, we have digital thermometers that work in one of two ways. The first is the simple probes that look like the old thermometers, just with a small screen. These have a metal tip which warms to the body temperature of the patient when it's touching it. Because metals have different resistance to electricity depending on their temperature, the thermometer can accurately measure the temperature by working backwards from the measured electrical resistance. Very clever. Then there are the in-ear thermometers that we commonly use in hospital, called tympanic thermometers. These use infrared light that bounces off the eardrum to detect how warm it is, which is much more accurate than the mouth and armpit. We've already touched on the most important application of body temperature in medicine, detecting a fever. A fever is when the body temperature is higher than the normal range. Typically, we say that a fever is anything above 38 degrees Celsius. So, if you're sitting at 37.7 degrees, don't sweat it. Heyo! Sorry about that. Fevers most commonly suggest that the body's fighting an infection. Go back to listen to episode 10 for a much more detailed explanation of what fevers are and how they work. But the gist of it is that the body turns up the heat to try cook off invading bacteria or viruses, while not going so hot to cook itself, usually. If the body temperature goes above 42 degrees Celsius, you run into the realm of possibly dying, because you can get irreparable brain damage. A high temperature might also suggest certain drugs or poisonings in the emergency department, such as meth. How about when the temperature is too cold? When your body temperature is below 35, you start becoming hypothermic, and your body doesn't like that. This is when you start shivering as your muscles try to make heat by twitching really quickly. As the body temperature drops, the body tries to conserve heat where it is most important, the core, as in your head and trunk. This is why your hands and feet go cold first in winter. But if it drops below 34 degrees Celsius, it starts becoming really dangerous. The brain starts to not work properly because everything is slowing down. You start to get confused and drowsy and sleepy, and paradoxically, you might even start taking clothes off rather than trying to get warm. Your blood also becomes less able to clot, which is why we try to keep people who have had a nasty traumatic accident warm so that they don't bleed as much. But when your body temperature gets really cold, like below 32 degrees, then it can even affect your heart. The heart becomes really irritable and you can have a fatal arrhythmia, causing a cardiac arrest, as in your heart will stop beating. So even from one vital sign, we can have a lot of work cut out for ourselves. If someone's too cold, we need to actively warm them with blankets, warm fluids, and maybe even an air warmer. If someone's burning up with a high fever, we need to figure out where the infection's coming from and treat the cause, because it's a sign that the body is fighting off invaders and it needs help. If they're hot because of something else, like heat stroke or a drug overdose, we might have to actively cool them by spraying them with water or paralyzing their body so it stops generating as much heat. Let's move on to our next vital sign, the pulse. As we talked about before, the pulse is possibly one of the oldest recorded clinical examination skills in history. Aside from the, he's not moving and his head is detached from the body, he might be dead. The pulse, or more specifically the heart rate, tells us a lot about a person's cardiovascular status. That is, how are their heart and blood vessels doing? It is literally how fast the heart is beating per minute. In a normal resting adult, the heart beats somewhere between 60 and 100 beats per minute. There are some super healthy individuals who do a lot of cardio who have a lower resting heart rate, like in the 50s too. Other than temperature, heart rate is probably the second most intuitive vital sign for the layperson, because we all feel our own heart beating inside our chest, and when it beats faster. When we exercise, our heart rate shoots up to the range of 120 to 160, even climbing to 200. Which is more than triple our normal heart rate. A similar thing happens when we're anxious, such as giving a presentation or going on a first date, or when we're terrified, like watching a horror movie or being on a roller coaster. This is because the heart is very responsive to various stimuli, to ensure that we have enough blood supply to different areas of the body. If we're exercising or getting ready to exercise through the fight or flight response, our muscles need more blood. So, our heart beats extra fast to pump blood more quickly around to meet this demand. The heart can also squeeze harder than normal, and it's the combination of how fast and how hard the heart beats that makes up for the heart's output power. This is controlled by chemicals such as adrenaline, or the brain that sends signals down nerves to increase or decrease the heart rate. By that logic, it means that an increased heart rate might suggest that the body is pumping out more adrenaline, because it's fighting something. The heart rate also goes up when your blood pressure is low, because it tries to compensate for the low pressure by just speeding up how fast blood circulates instead, like how you can unblock a toilet by pouring more water into the bowl while flushing it. Same thing. This means that if you have a person come to the hospital and they have a high heart rate, it might be because they're just anxious or think the doctor, like yours truly, is just oh so dreamy. But more likely, it means that the body is hiding something. It might be fighting an infection, there might be some inflammation going on, the blood pressure might be dropping because of bleeding, or their hormones are off balance, such as the thyroid. Or their heart might be doing something funny, like being in an erratic rhythm, such as atrial fibrillation or SVT, common conditions where the electricity in the heart is uncontrolled and results in it beating uncontrollably fast. So, how do you measure the heart rate? Well, you probably already know how to take your own pulse. You just put your fingertips over your wrist or under the angle of the jaw, feeling for the pulse. Then you count. Normally, we count for about 15 seconds instead of the whole minute, then times that number by 4, which gives you the beats per minute. So, if you count 20 beats of pulse in 15 seconds, then the heart rate must be 80. The radial pulse on the wrist and the carotid pulse on the neck are just two places you can take the pulse. There are many, many more. There's the femoral pulse in the groin, the dorsalis pedis pulse in the foot, the brachial pulse in the bend of your arm. You can even directly feel for the heartbeat in the chest called the apex beat. Cool name for a band, I think. A pulse is essentially feeling the oomph of the heart squeeze being transmitted down your arteries as a column of blood. Because your heart is beating rhythmically and your blood vessels are always full of blood, every squeeze of the heart pushes a volume of blood into the blood vessels, which then pushes the blood in there forwards. Works exactly the same ways as hydraulics in car brakes or airplanes. Anyway, an experienced clinician can learn more than just the heart rate from taking the pulse. You can also assess the rhythm of the heart to figure out if they have an arrhythmia, or you can feel how strong the pulse is to estimate the blood pressure. Because if the blood pressure is too low, you're not even going to feel the pulse in the wrist. If you're really good, you can even tell that a person's heart has faulty valves from how the pulse rises and falls. This is probably where the whole Ars Sphygmica, or ancient art of pulse taking that is the basis of traditional Chinese and Indian medicine, comes from. There are other ways of measuring the heart rate too. You can listen to the heart with a stethoscope, or use machines such as an ECG or a pulse oximeter to measure the heart rate accurately, either by reading the electricity of the heart or seeing tiny pulsations on the finger, respectively. One way or another, the pulse is an easily accessible sign that can give us a lot of information very quickly. It can tell us if your heart is beating too fast, which might suggest there's something bad going on, or the absence of a heart rate, which might tell us that we need to start CPR like right now because the heart is not beating at all. Let's take a short break, and when we're back, we'll talk about the third vital sign that is also related to the heart, blood pressure. Welcome back. So we've already touched on the concept of blood pressure. When your heart pumps, it's pushing a column of blood down the arteries, which pushes all the blood ahead of it, driving forward through the circulatory system until it makes its way back to the heart. Blood pressure is simply measuring the pressure that the blood is pushed around with. You'll notice that blood pressure always comes in two numbers, like 120 over 80. The first number is called the systolic blood pressure, and this is the peak blood pressure when the heart is directly squeezing the blood out. The second number is called the diastolic blood pressure, and this is what the pressure in the blood vessel falls to when the heart is relaxing. So you can think of it as the resting pressure. Every heartbeat consists of a squeezing phase and a relaxing phase, so that's why both the systolic and diastolic blood pressure are important. Now, blood pressure is important because you need a certain amount of pressure to safely deliver blood to the vital organs, like the kidneys, brain, liver, etc. You know, like how if the shower pressure is too weak, it'll just dribble onto your feet, instead of letting you have a proper shower. There are many things that affect blood pressure, but predominantly, we look at two things: how much blood the heart is pumping, and how tight the blood vessels are. We've already talked about the cardiac output, or how much the heart is pumping in the heart rate section. Depends on how fast and how strongly the heart is beating. The other factor, systemic vascular resistance, sounds a lot more complicated than it is. Think of it this way: the tighter and narrower the tube, the higher the pressure, because physics. Like how sucking milkshake through a big straw is much easier than a narrow one. The body uses this to its advantage because it can control how tight the blood vessels are thanks to muscles in the vessel walls. This means that if the blood pressure is too low, the body can tell the blood vessels to pucker up, increasing the resistance and thus increasing the blood pressure. being able to control their blood pressure is really important, because lots of things can make your blood pressure drop. The simplest cause is just not enough blood, or more specifically, not enough water. If you get really dehydrated, your blood also gets dehydrated, so you have less to pump around the system, like a sad sprinkler with a broken tap. Similarly, if you bleed too much, your blood pressure will eventually drop. Another cause of low blood pressure is when the blood vessels are too relaxed and floppy, like when you have a nasty infection, because the bacteria can release chemicals that force the blood vessels to relax. You could also have something go wrong with the heart, like a blockage from a giant clot, or a weakened heart due to a heart attack, or the heart beating so fast and erratically from an arrhythmia that it's not effectively pumping blood. One way or another, your body will try to compensate for the low blood pressure by telling your heart to beat faster, or by trying to tighten the blood vessels. But if you don't fix the cause, you'll eventually die because all of your organs will be starved of oxygen and fuel. If you want to experience what not enough blood to the brain feels like, just try jumping straight out of bed in the morning when you've woken up, bolt upright and standing. A lot of blood will suddenly rush to the leg muscles where there's space, meaning the body suddenly has less blood to distribute throughout the body. This means not enough blood to the brain, which makes you dizzy and lightheaded, like you're about to faint. If you're young and healthy though, the body will adjust for this and bring your blood pressure back up to speed. Alright, so blood pressure is good. But what if we have too much blood pressure? Will we pop like an overinflated balloon animal? Yes and no. For the most part, high blood pressure is rarely damaging in the acute setting, unless it's really, really high, like over 200 systolic. If you have super high blood pressure, it can rupture the delicate blood vessels in your brain and nose and eyes, while stressing your heart because it's pushing against a really high pressure system. The real problem with high blood pressure is that in the long run, like over years and decades, it damages the inner lining of the blood vessels, especially in the kidneys. So, if you don't control your blood pressure, it can increase your risk of kidney damage and heart attacks and strokes, because the blood vessels are getting worn out by the high pressure. So, how do we measure blood pressure? The simple answer is that nowadays, we just use a machine that automatically inflates a cuff around your biceps and measures it using machine magic. But the more complicated answer involves turbulence. What we're doing with the inflatable cuff is pumping it up so high that the pressure of the cuff is higher than your systolic blood pressure. This becomes a tourniquet, cutting the blood flow off to the rest of your arm. This means you'll no longer feel the radial pulse in the wrist. Now, if you slowly release the pressure on the cuff, eventually the pressure will become just lower than the systolic blood pressure, letting some blood flow back into your arm. Because you've still got pressure on the artery, the blood flow becomes very turbulent, much like when you pinch a garden hose and it sprays water in a fine mist, instead of a smooth jet. It's also because the blood is sometimes flowing through the artery, because remember, the blood pressure goes up and down between the systolic and diastolic blood pressure. So if the cuff pressure is somewhere between these two pressures, you're getting some peaks of blood coming in, but when it's down to the lowest blood pressure, the blood flow stops again. We can hear this turbulence with a stethoscope, which we call Krotkoff sounds. The pressure that we start hearing the sound is what the patient's systolic blood pressure is. If we keep releasing the pressure on the cuff, the Krotkoff sounds eventually disappear. This is what the diastolic pressure is, because now the blood is flowing smoothly through the artery the whole time with no turbulence. Blood pressure machines can sense this turbulence automatically, which makes our jobs a lot easier nowadays. That said, if someone's really sick and they have a critically low blood pressure, we still need to take it manually, or use pulses as a surrogate measure. If someone has a low blood pressure, like below 80 systolic, then their radial pulse starts weakening. Below 70, the femoral pulse in the groin goes away. The last pulse to stay is the carotid pulse in the neck, which disappears below 60 systolic, which is a critically low blood pressure where the brain is not getting enough blood flow to stay alive. So even if we don't have a sphygmomanometer, which is the fancy word for a blood pressure machine, slash an epic Scrabble word, we can guesstimate that a patient has at least a certain amount of blood pressure just by feeling their pulse. Alright, let's move on to our fourth and last, or maybe not really last, vital sign, which is the respiratory rate. The respiratory rate is simply how fast you're breathing. Normally, people breathe at a rate of 12 to 20 breaths per minute, which is about one breath every 3 to 5 seconds. You know, unless you suddenly became very conscious of your breathing and it screws up your breathing patterns. Like when Morpheus helpfully asks,
"You think that's air you're breathing now?"
Breathing is obviously necessary for life, because it gives your blood fresh oxygen while breathing out toxic carbon dioxide. If you breathe faster or deeper, you get more exchange of these gases. So if someone's breathing quite fast, we might start thinking it's because their body wants more oxygen for some reason. Heavy breathing when something excites or intrigues you is a bit of a meme on the internet, but it's true. When you're aroused, your body releases more adrenaline, which tells your chest to breathe faster and deeper to get more oxygen into your system. You know, in case you need to fight or take flight or have some kind of other vigorous physical activity to prepare for. You'll also breathe faster in response to things, like when you're afraid, anxious, in pain, or when you exercise. But sometimes, you're breathing fast because your body is sick and needs more oxygen. This might be because your body is burning more fuel while fighting an infection, or because your lungs aren't able to do their jobs as well, because there's a lot of gunk or swelling or fluid blocking the little airways, preventing gas exchange. To compensate, your body makes you breathe faster and faster. You can see this effect particularly clearly in children, where their rest rate can get really high when they're sick, like 1 per second. Funnily enough, it's been shown that a fast respiratory rate is the strongest predictor of somebody in hospital having a life-threatening event, because it's one of the earliest changes when the body is becoming sick. So even though we don't think much of it, it's actually a very important sign. Vital, in fact. We don't talk much about breathing too slow, because it typically only happens with some sedative medications such as morphine or benzodiazepines. We do care a lot about when someone's not breathing at all though, and this is called apnea, because, you know, you gotta breathe to live. And we'll talk a little bit more about this in the 2-minute explain at the end. Measuring the respiratory rate is surprisingly simple. You just count it. Nurses are particularly good at it because they routinely take people's vital signs, or OBS. Normally we look at a person's chest rising and falling for about 20 seconds, then times that number by 3 to figure out how many breaths there are per minute. So that's about it for the 4 vital signs. But wait, I keep alluding to a 5th vital sign. What could that be? Throughout medical history, people have been trying to add an official 5th vital sign because, I don't know, we got bored of just having 4? During the 1990s, the American Pain Society advocated for pain to be the 5th vital sign because they argued that we needed to address acute and chronic pain better in healthcare settings so people got appropriate pain relief. And as good of a gesture this was, and probably an important thing to address, unfortunately, this coincided with drug companies developing more and more effective, but very addictive opioid medications. So the push for pain relief, being a goal in healthcare, inadvertently fueled the ever-worsening opioid crisis in the USA. Blood sugar, or the glucose level, has also been pushed as a potential vital sign, because it's an easily missed clinical investigation. But it's really more of an investigation rather than a clinical sign. Plus, it's a tad more invasive than the others, involving a needle. It is super important in pediatric medicine, though, because kids often have low blood sugar when they're sick. Hence, the acronym DEFG coming after the ABCs. Don't ever forget glucose. But above pain and blood sugar, as an emergency specialist, I would argue that the real 5th vital sign is the oxygen saturation level, also called O2 sats. Like I mentioned, the most important thing that blood carries is oxygen. It does this with a clever protein found in red blood cells called hemoglobin. Hemoglobin uses iron molecules to bind oxygen, carrying them to where it's needed and dropping it off. In the ideal world, all of the hemoglobin should be carrying oxygen in the arterial blood, so the saturation should be 100%. Realistically, anything above 95% is fine for most situations. Sats are super useful because all you need to do is put a probe on someone's finger or ear and you immediately know how much oxygen their blood is carrying. This lets us decide how much extra oxygen we might need to give them, while helping us figuring out if there's a respiratory issue, as in the lungs or the airway. It's non-invasive, quick to apply, and it's dynamic, so it's useful in fluctuant situations like when we're intubating a patient. That's when you put someone in an induced coma, then put a breathing tube into their windpipe, so you can protect the airway and breathe for a patient, because they're really, really sick, or needing an operation and have a general anesthetic being done. We want to know while we're putting stuff in someone's airway if their body's tolerating it, and if we need to stop and re-oxygenate the patient before attempting again. Because if the body doesn't have enough oxygen, you can quickly develop brain damage in a matter of minutes, because the brain is a hungry, hungry hippo. Generally, we start getting concerned when the sats fall below 90%, because hemoglobin is less likely to hold onto oxygen when there is not enough oxygen around. So it's a bit of a slippery slope, and the oxygen level can fall surprisingly quicker than expected the lower it gets. O2 sats have become more familiar and recognized by the general populace thanks to COVID-19, where one of the early markers of moderate or severe disease was a low O2 sat number, which suggests that the lungs are inflamed and not effectively exchanging gas. So what sorcery do we use to measure oxygen level in the blood without needles? Well, we can use some clever physics laws and crafty use of light. If you look at a sats probe, you can see that it's shining a red light, like the barcode scanners at the supermarket. This red light is actually made up of two specific frequency light waves, red and infrared. This fact is very useful because hemoglobin absorbs different amounts of red and infrared light depending on whether it's oxygenated or deoxygenated, as in not carrying any oxygen. And you can see this visually too. If you take blood from an artery where it's full of oxygen, the blood is bright red. But blood from a vein where there's much less oxygen left, it's a dark brownish red, because the two bloods are reflecting different amounts of red light. So if you shine the light through blood vessels, say in the finger or the earlobe, we can measure how much red and infrared light makes it to the other side. Whatever light doesn't make it through is presumed to be absorbed by the hemoglobin. Now, thanks to physics, we know that the more concentrated a substance such as hemoglobin is, the more light it absorbs. This makes sense, right? It's easier to see through diluted juice compared to concentrated juice. We also know that the more distance the light has to travel through a substance, more light is absorbed, as in the bigger the cup of juice, the less light will get through to the other side. Using these laws, known as the Beer-Lambert law, the SATS probe can accurately calculate not only the concentration of oxygenated versus deoxygenated hemoglobin, but it can also calculate the width of blood, so to speak. The width, as in the width of the blood vessel, changes with every heartbeat. When blood is freshly squeezed through the vessel, it gets slightly wider. Therefore, the SATS probe can see the pulse. This is how we figure out the heart rate from the SATS probe. Anyway, now that we know the concentration of oxygenated versus deoxygenated hemoglobin, we can calculate the oxygen saturation level, as in what proportion of all the hemoglobin is carrying oxygen. The machine will convert this into a handy percentage figure, while giving us a pretty waveform that shows the pulse as well. Interesting tangent for the medical folk listening. When they first started experimenting with SATS probes, they used experimental data to figure out what ratio of light absorption equated to what oxygen sat level. They took healthy volunteers, then made them breathe gas with less oxygen, making them more and more hypoxic. Then they could measure the real blood oxygen saturation level plus what the SAT probe was showing to create a graph that synced up the values. Unfortunately, it's highly unethical to suffocate someone, so they could only experiment down to a SATS level of 85%. Anything lower, and they had a real risk of giving people brain damage. This means that any data below 85% is extrapolated, making the measurements inaccurate compared to real-life data. Combined with the fact that the hemoglobin-oxygen dissociation curve gets steeper and steeper as the oxygen partial pressure drops off, you should really be concerned when a patient's sats are lower than 85%, because they might actually be a lot more hypoxic than you are led to believe by the machine. Now, there are some other inaccuracies that can happen with the sats probe. Because it measures light absorption, ambient light can interfere with accurate measurement. Fortunately, the makers of the probes account for this and have a system where the probe automatically corrects for the background light to clean up the signal. The SATS probe will also do a thing where it only takes the pulsatile signal, that is, the signal that shows the distance is going up and down with the pulse, and then it amplifies that signal. This lets it isolate the real signal and reduces movement artifacts, because it knows that the pulsatile signal is probably the most important thing. You can imagine if someone's waving their hand around, the SATS probe might not be able to accurately read the light signals or figure out if the movement is from the patient or from the blood vessel width changing. So this is all very important. There are even newer SATS probes nowadays that uses algorithms and AI to try reduce artifacts for a more accurate recording on oxygen levels, kind of like noise cancelling on headphones and Zoom. One other weird way the SATS probe can be fooled is if it thinks it's looking at oxygenated hemoglobin, but it's not actually carrying oxygen. There's a specific condition called carbon monoxide poisoning that can happen with gas inhalation or fires. Carbon monoxide likes to bind to hemoglobin, much stronger than oxygen. Like the seductive secretary in Love Actually luring Alan Rickman away from poor Emma Thompson, carbon monoxide prevents hemoglobin from doing its duties, distracting it from carrying any oxygen. But because of physics, hemoglobin carrying carbon monoxide looks exactly the same as oxygenated hemoglobin to the SATS probe, because it absorbs red and infrared light in the same pattern. This means that the SATS probe might be saying 100%, even if the patient's blood is starved of oxygen. It's a really weird, but very cool scientific phenomenon. Anyway, that's probably enough about vital signs today. Remember that medicine carries a lot of variants, so the normal vital sign doesn't always apply to everyone. A heart rate of 45 might be dangerous for an elderly person, but normal for a marathon runner. Petite women might normally have a low blood pressure, while old people need a higher blood pressure to deliver the same amount of blood to their organs, because their blood vessels are stiffer. And don't get me started on children, where their normal vital signs values completely change depending on their age. And I don't have to memorize those numbers anymore, because my exams are over and I work in an adult ED. But hopefully, you now have a much better understanding of all the different measurements we can take to check how healthy our patients are, and when we become worried. Plus, all the cool science behind how we actually measure them. So, what did we learn today? We learned about the vital signs, key clinical signs and measurements that give clinicians an indicator of a person's health, and the risk of them having a life-threatening condition. We learned about what heart rate, respiratory rate, blood pressure, and temperature are, how it's relevant in keeping you alive, and what can go wrong with them. We also learned about the oxygen saturation, which is considered pretty much the fifth vital sign nowadays. We learned about how all of these vital signs are measured, from simple counting to fancy machines using light absorption. We also learned that the body is a very interconnected system, with lots of self-correcting mechanisms to keep you alive and healthy. Alright, for today's 2-Minute Explain, we're gonna get really deep and technical, but mostly targeted for doctors and nurses. It might also run way over 2 minutes for your information. Feel free to tune in if you want to understand more about how your brain controls your breathing when you're sleeping. But if it's getting way too confusing for you, don't worry. Feel free to switch off and tune into next week's episode instead. Today's episode was inspired by a conversation I had with another emergency specialist after we read a paper on a peculiar phenomenon that can kill patients in their sleep that hadn't been well recognized until recently. So this one's for you, Heidi. We know that when people have respiratory failure, they die from two main causes. Type 1 is when the respiratory rate gets faster and faster to compensate for hypoxia, as seen in heart failure and sepsis. The hyperventilation might mask how unwell and unstable the patient is until they can't compensate any longer and die from hypoxia. Type 2 is when there is not enough gas exchange, causing carbon dioxide to build up, resulting in CO2 narcosis, as it's seen in severe COPD, asthma, and also opioid overdose. In both situations, the O2 sats tend to decrease progressively, which is why we look out for low sats and respond to the trend of decreasing sats. You know, like how I was talking about how we only really worry when sats drop below 90%. However, turns out there is a third type of respiratory failure where a person might look like they have normal sats until they suddenly don't. This typically affects people with sleep apnea, diagnosed or undiagnosed, and can be particularly an issue if they have sedatives on board, such as morphine or benzodiazepines. In these patients, they may be saturating fine while they're awake, but when they sleep, they might display a peculiar pattern on their monitoring, where the alarm keeps going off periodically saying that the sats are low, but then when you get there, the sats are coming back up again by themselves. This gives clinicians a false sense of security because it looks like, just another episode of sleep apnea, where the breathing gets a bit obstructed, then the brain senses the rising CO2, then becomes a bit more alert to take deeper breaths. The cycle continues until the patient wakes up with no long-term damage. Easy, right? But in reality, what the pattern shows is that the patient is at risk of unexpected death from apnea. This is because of a phenomenon called arousal failure. You see, in normal sleep, even with OSA, The brain has a sensor that notifies that the CO2 levels are rising, so it needs to be aroused to breathe better. It's a clever evolutionary feature, so you don't die in your sleep because you're not breathing enough or just because you're about to snore. The problem in OSA is that the soft tissues around the airway can get too relaxed and cause an obstruction. This is why if you plotted the sats of these patients while they sleep, it would look like a zigzag. The sats slowly drop below 90 due to the airway obstruction, then suddenly go up near 100% as they go and take a big breath. Then it slowly drops off again, and keeps repeating ad infinitum. So, like I said, normally this process continues throughout the sleep until the person wakes up. But what if the brain forgets to arouse itself to breathe better? This can happen when even normal doses of narcotics and sedatives are given to patients, even if it's nowhere near the dose required to affect the awake person's breathing. In this situation, the brain doesn't become alerted to the fact that the sats are dropping, and the sats just keep dropping and dropping and dropping and dropping, until the brain doesn't get enough oxygen so the arousal system doesn't even function at all, because you're getting brain damage. The worst part is, there's no warning for when the arousal failure might occur. The only warning you get is the repetitive cycle of desaturations that you would normally see in sleep apnea. If the patient doesn't recover from their apnea, the sats will keep dropping until the patient silently dies in their sleep. This can happen very rapidly too, and often goes unnoticed by nurses and doctors looking after the patient, who might also be so used to the repetitive desaturation alarms that they get a bit of the boy who cried wolf syndrome, or alarm fatigue. There's numerous cases, especially from the States, where many people have been sued for malpractice because supposedly they gave the patient too much opiates or didn't recognize that the patient was deteriorating. But if you look at the evidence, it shows that the patient looked completely fine until suddenly they weren't when they went to sleep. So how do we prevent people from dying unexpectedly in these situations? The first is being aware that the phenomenon even exists. This means that you're extra vigilant with patients with possible OSA who have been given sedatives or narcotics, particularly those who have had an overdose when they go to sleep. We've already discussed that threshold-based alarms are not very effective in these situations, because it'll alarm and then the sats will come back up again. So OBS should be taken physically and frequently to check if the patient is actually breathing instead of just relying on the alarms. This also means that the patients would benefit from being in a visible bed space rather than a dark corner of short stay. Even then, it's difficult because these patients can go from looking really well and really alert to dead within 10 minutes when they go to sleep. Another thing is to look out for the pattern of cyclic desaturations, which may be a harbinger of unexpected silent apneas. Don't just dismiss it as a poor trace or a movement artifact. There are new monitors being developed that try to identify patterns of various vital sign changes to assist healthcare workers, such as connecting the dots of cyclical desaturations and changes in rest rates, but unfortunately they're not widely used yet. Hopefully, the evolving field of AI helps us take care of patients, as well as generating some eerily good, creepy, quick, but also ethically dubious art. So unfortunately, there are no easy solutions on whether you can predict arousal failure or recognizing when it's happening, despite how scarily common the scenario is. The best we can do is to educate ourselves in the potential risk, because if you don't know what you're looking out for, you're bound to miss it. Just something to think about the next time you see an agitated, obese patient who has been given sedation and now happily snoring away. Well, that's it for today. Thank you for listening to Explain This. Hope you've learned something interesting and maybe even useful today. I also noticed that it's been just over 2 years since I've started making this podcast. Thank you all for listening and sticking with me through exam-related hiatuses and experimenting with the podcast format. I love making this podcast because I get to share my knowledge while learning new things through the research progress as I figure out myself what the heck is happening in this weird and wonderful world. Like magnets, just... Anyway, I'm always open to hearing ways I can improve and keep the podcast interesting and thinking of ways to keep it going strong and sustainable, so please feel free to send me feedback on social media or by email. I appreciate the heck out of all of you. We'll see you next time. Bye for now. Explain This was written and hosted by me, Jin Kim. If you'd like to suggest a topic or just send a lovely message, you can email me at explainthiscast@gmail.com or follow me on Facebook or Twitter.